Joshy says, "Wow, that was good singing, right?" I'd say so. What's that? I think he is singing. That's good. You have to love that song, "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." And if you don't love that song, you really should love that song, because it's a great song. I mean, you're entitled to your own opinions, but you know, some people are just wrong. It's a fantastic, fantastic song, but the last verse, I think we all probably struggle with. I mean, we all love the first. "A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing. Our helper, he amidst the flood of mortal ills prevailing." We say, amen. That's fantastic stuff. And then you get to the last verse where he says, "Let goods and kindred go. And this mortal life also." And we say, but I kind of like my stuff. And I kind of like the people around me. I kind of like my life. It's hard to give up that stuff. It's hard to depart from those things because we're very, very attached to them. Paul, the entire time as we have traced him heading towards Jerusalem, has reiterated over and over again, and yes, I know that's redundant. It's redundant on purpose. He's reiterated, "My life means nothing to me because I know the task that God has given me to preach the gospel, and that's what it's important." Here's what's really hard for us to get our heads around, is our identity and purpose in Christ is not about our stuff. It is not primarily about the people around us, although that flows out of our relationship with Christ. I am not first and foremost a pastor. I belong to Christ. Now that has implications for me as a pastor. I am not first and foremost a husband or father. I am first and foremost a follower of Christ. But that has implications for how I husband and how I father, doesn't it? But we like to get the cart before the horse and put the second things first and mix everything up and try to find our identity in other things. Paul didn't seem to struggle with that. And I'm not saying he was super Christian and never had these kinds of struggles or thoughts in his own mind, but the resolve he finally came to was, "My life means nothing to me except to finish the race that God has given me, and that is to preach the gospel." He had this certainty about him that said, "I know what God put me here to do, and I'm going to, as best I can, accomplish it." So Paul traveled to Jerusalem. He met with the elders in Jerusalem. He delivered his charge of the offering for the poor saints in Jerusalem, though Luke mentions nothing about it. Interesting little tidbit in Luke's narrative that he actually doesn't mention the offering at all as he's compiling this narrative of Paul's events. We pick up that information about the offering from Paul's letters and what he was trying to do. Luke never mentions it. So whether it didn't have the effect Paul was hoping or whether Luke's purposes just didn't include that offering, we're not sure. But it just isn't in the book of Acts. So he meets with the elders in Jerusalem in verses 15 and 16. Verse 17 and 18. And he greets the church there, and they present him with this problem, which we talked about last week, that, hey, look, everybody everywhere has heard that you're preaching that Jewish people should abandon the law and all the customs and should just live licentiously. Now, we know that's not true, but we want to be able to counter those arguments, and so here's our idea. We have four men. They're Jewish Christians. They've taken a vow, a Nazarite vow. So we would like you to take the vow with them, finish out the days of purification, and then pay for their sacrifices. Yeah, these are Christians who believe in the sacrifice of Christ, but they're still participating in temple worship with animal sacrifices and all that goes along with that. Now, Paul's teaching, as we looked again last week, we looked at this. Paul's teaching throughout the New Testament was, if a believer wants to follow those kinds of things, that's great. Let them. If that's something that they find meaningful, purposeful, then let them follow it. As long as they're not attaching salvation merit to the event. As long as they're not teaching that in order to be a Christian, you have to perform these rituals. That alters the gospel, and that he would stand against. But If they are simply involved in these rituals and they find some spiritual meaning in them, then he says, go ahead, go along with it. And so he displays that kind of grace towards these Jewish believers, and he goes along with this. And that's where we find him in verse 27. He's in the temple. He's finishing up these days of purification. Now, back in the last section, we found out that there were 7 days left, which means Paul arrives in Jerusalem. The next day he meets with the elders. Probably the day after that he begins the purification process with these men. So this is about a week later, and verse 27 tells us when the 7 days were almost completed, which tells us, you know, we're getting close. We're not completely a week, but maybe it's like the seventh day. Paul is in the temple, so there's a good chance he's in there getting ready to offer the final sacrifices that are needed to finish this vow with these 4 men. So we see him in the temple there, nearly completing his time, and probably thinking to himself, well, this has been a fantastic opportunity to unite the Jewish side of the church with the Gentile side of the church and show both that, hey, we can get along, we can have a united church, we can have a strong church, even if we have some disagreements about these secondary issues. And just when all was going quietly, Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple. Now you might start thinking, what are Jews from Asia? How did they see him in the temple? But remember why Paul's here. He wanted to get to Jerusalem before the day of Pentecost. Pentecost was a major feast day. And so Jews from all over the Roman Empire had probably pilgrimed to Jerusalem to take part in the Feast of Pentecost. So it shouldn't surprise us that Jews from Asia are here in Jerusalem during this feast. Now, where has Paul just spent the last 3 years of his ministry? Ephesus, which is the capital of Asia. How did the Jews in Asia respond to Paul's preaching? It wasn't well. They didn't respond well. Some of them did, like in every city he goes to, but the Jews in Asia fought with him pretty bitterly, we learn about from some of his books. And so here's Paul, he's in the temple, he's offering these sacrifices, and suddenly they spot him across the temple courtyard and say, wait a second, that's Paul, he's here in the temple. Now they see an opportunity to silence this man that they've had so much trouble with throughout the years. And so end of verse 27, they stirred up the whole crowd. It's kind of like this idea of whipping something into a frenzy, right? They start shouting out that they need help. They're crying out, verse 28, men of Israel, help! This is a very powerful term that they use here. Come to our aid. You ever hear somebody, you know, cry out fire? Is that just for your information? Fire! Oh no, I just wanted you to notice there was a fire over there, right? No, there's an implied call to action in that. And this word help is the same way. There's an implied, everybody needs to gather together. We need action right now. And so they start crying out in the middle of the temple. Help! Here's their problem. This is the man who is teaching everyone everywhere against the people and the law and this place. These are great charges, by the way. I say great kind of facetiously. It's highly, highly emphatic. Everything these Jewish men are saying is emotionally charged to try and whip the entire temple precincts into a frenzy. Even the way they state who this is the man. As if there's not any other men that are causing trouble in Israel at this time, right? But this is the guy. This is the one that's causing us so much trouble. What's he doing? They say he's teaching against the people. Well, if I started talking to you about the people, who would you assume I'm talking about? I mean, people are people. Obviously, we live in a day and age which is highly charged too when we're talking about people groups. There's a need to address issues like racism and discrimination. Because unfortunately, not all the different people groups mingle together very well. People that are highly different from us, we look at a little bit askew, sometimes a little mistrusting, and part of it's just the reality of life that we live in. But as the church, we're supposed to be called to overcome those things. But we don't generally refer to ourselves as the people, the specific, the one and only, the epitome of all peoples. We're the people. But that's exactly what they do here, and they're talking, of course, about Jews. Their accusation then is that Paul preaches everywhere all the time against the Jews, the people, the favored people, the chosen people, God's people, however you want to put this. It's kind of all lumped together in that term there, the people. Presumably, it's because he preaches that God's also accepting these uncircumcised dogs of the Gentiles. Well, if God's accepting the Gentiles, does that have implications for the specialness of the Jews? And in their minds, it did. If God accepts the Gentiles, that must mean the Jews really aren't all that special. Therefore, Paul's trying to pull down the Jewish people. There's the reasoning going on in their minds. Is this true? Does God's election of the Gentiles mean anything against his election of the Jewish people? No. It just means that God is abundantly good, more than we could think of him. God is gracious. And it doesn't mean that his election of one person is any less special than his election of somebody else. We don't have to hope for condemnation on other people just to make ourselves feel more special about what we've got. Well, unfortunately, that's kind of how we respond sometimes in our sinful state. So he's not only preaching against the people, he's preaching against the law. Now, did Paul preach against the law? Read the book of Galatians. Paul's very specific. The law is meaningful. It has purpose. He talks to Timothy in the book of Timothy also and says the law is good if one uses it lawfully. What's the problem with the law? You can't be saved by keeping it. And that's the problem. That's what Paul preached against, was that tendency to say, well, we've got this list of do's and don'ts, and if we can just do all this that it says to do and avoid all these things that it says to not do, then we're going to be good. And Paul's problem was, that's not the gospel. That's a gospel of self-righteousness. That's a gospel of pride and arrogance. That's a gospel that tears down the grace of God that's offered to us through Christ. So Paul wasn't preaching against the law, but they sort of perceived it that way because he taught grace. The law is good because it defines what's right and wrong. The only trouble for us is that once we've defined right and wrong, we realize just how wrong we are. Because once we've clearly defined right and wrong, we realize that I'm not right and I need help. And that's where the gospel of grace comes in. So the Jewish people, they like to prove their goodness and prove their acceptability in God's sight by pointing to their obedience to the law. Paul says that's the problem, it's not the law. So he didn't teach against the law, but that's what they're asserting. He also teaches against this place, meaning the temple. Because Paul did go around preaching to the Gentiles, you don't have to offer the sacrifices in order to be saved, because guess what? It's already been done. The Passover that's commanded every year, Jesus is the Passover lamb. Those morning and evening sacrifices, guess what? Jesus is the sacrifice. His blood is what sanctifies us. Those things are shadows of what he is. They were supposed to point us to him, but once we've got him, we don't need them anymore. And so, again, the Jewish people took that to say, Paul's trying to tear down our entire sacrificial system. He's trying to destroy our way of life. So now, none of these accusations are true. But if there's one thing that's certain in life, you can count on your enemies to misrepresent your position. I've heard it said before, you don't have to promote the weaknesses of your argument. Your enemies will do it for you. Work on promoting the good sides of the argument. So using those accusations, they whip up all the people in the temple into a frenzy. Now, we have to note here some of what's going on behind the scenes. We are in about AD 57. Anti-Roman sentiment in Judea at this time is running at all-time high levels. We are just 13 years away from the destruction of Jerusalem. Just 13 years. Now think back 13 years. I mean, 13 years in the future sounds like a long time, right? What are you going to be doing 13 years from now? Abby, what do you think you'll be doing? Not a clue, right? Being 26, huh? Okay. Kathy, how about you? What do you think you'll be doing in 13 years? You have no idea. Right? That's a long way off, isn't it? Feels like a long way. Now look backward 13 years. What were you doing 13 years ago? Sucking your thumb. Mm-hmm. Doesn't feel like that long ago, though, does it? I mean, 13 years just kind of... And the kids are all saying, yeah, right. You know, 3 days is a long time. But for us, you know, the older you get, the quicker time passes. I think it's just something about the clock in your brain breaks as you get older, and time just starts to whip by you. But anti-Roman sentiment in this period is running really, really high. Part of the reason is because the Jews are getting sick and tired of a fellow named Felix. He's been the Roman governor for some time. He became Roman governor in AD 52 or so. And the Roman historian Tacitus relates for us that Felix wielded the power of command with all the instincts of a slave. He was brutal to the Jewish people. Anything that Felix perceived as a threat to the Roman rule, he put down with bloody brutality. Crucifixions were very, very common in this time. And because of his heavy-handedness in administering the state of Israel at the time, the Jewish people were rising up in their sentiments. They were becoming more and more pro-Israel. They were becoming more and more patriotic. They were becoming more and more ready to rise in rebellion against the Roman Empire. You understand, as times get harder and as governments try to crush people and keep them in a tight grip, that people's sentiments rise to match. Whatever pressure is being exerted inward tends to be matched in an outward way. And so because of Felix's abuses, Jewish patriotism was on the rise, and many people were beginning to proclaim that it was time for revolt. It was time to rebel. It was time to overthrow the Romans. Now, there were some Jews who took this to extreme measures. They actually did raise some armies. We're going to read about one of them. Actually, Luke mentions him. When Paul is arrested and the Roman tribune says to Paul, "Aren't you that Egyptian who took those men out into the wilderness?" That was an actual event. It happened. Other historians talk about it. A Jew from Egypt rose up an army of several thousand people, and he was going to march on Jerusalem and try to overthrow the Roman garrison there. Well, the Romans slaughtered the Jewish people in that, crushed that revolt, and the Egyptian escaped. And so this Roman, on high alert because of all the rebellions, because of all the sedition, asks Paul, aren't you the Egyptian? Are you the guy that got away? And he's probably ready to just run Paul through. Some other things were going on is that many Jewish people, in their zealousness for the Jewish nation, figured that the way to win the war was not necessarily through overt armies, but through covert acts of assassination. And so the group of people called the Sicarii was arising, and they would carry this curved dagger under the cloaks, their robes, and in full view of the public, out in very, very crowded places, they would assassinate their enemies. Just walk up to them, plunge in the dagger, and then they would disappear into the crowds, and most of the time they got away with it. And so imagine what life would be like. Walking into Jerusalem, and you don't know if you go into the temple, you see friend or foe approaching you, you might not be certain that he's not coming to do you in because there were so many of these things going on. So tensions were high. So when these men start crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the guy! We got to get him!" Everybody says, "All right, let's get him." And they're whipped into a frenzy and they come rushing after Paul. So they have one more charge to bring against him, though. He's not only preaching against the people and the law and this place. Moreover, he even brought Greeks into the temple. And there they're playing on this anti-Gentile sentiment that is running really, really high right now. They say, "Paul brought Gentiles into the temple and has defiled this holy place." Now, if you know anything about the temple, you know the temple proper was a building, very tall, very ornate, beautiful building. The only people allowed inside that were the priests. Outside that temple was a court where the offerings were made, where the altar of burnt offering was, and the bronze lavers to wash things, and the priests and worshipers, men, were allowed in there. Outside that was what's called the court of the women. And the lady Jews were allowed into that, but outside of that was called the court of the Gentiles. And historians tell us there was a 4-foot wall that separated the court of the Gentiles from the rest of the temple. And the Romans actually granted the Jewish people the right of execution to any Gentile that broke that barrier. And so if a Gentile crossed into the forbidden area, the Romans said, "You don't even have to try the guy, just drag him outside the city and execute him." And so when these worshipers, these Jewish people, are crying these things out. He's even brought a Gentile in here. They are calling for an immediate death penalty upon Paul for violating the temple precincts, and they have Roman legal authority to do it. This isn't a mob rule like Paul has faced. I mean, it's a mob, but it's not an illegal mob. You understand sometimes what's legal is not necessarily what's good and moral. There's a distinction. We would love for everything that is moral to be legal, everything that's immoral to be illegal, but you know when that'll happen? When Christ rules. Never on this side of the kingdom will we see that sort of alignment between what's good and what's legal. So don't look for it too strongly. So he's even brought Greeks into the temple. He's defiled the holy place. Verse 29, why do they come to that conclusion? Luke wants to explain this. Because they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian with him in the city, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. How's that for evidence? The line of reasoning goes like this. I saw Paul earlier out in the marketplace, and he had Trophimus with him. I see Paul now in the temple. Ergo, Trophimus must be in the temple. It's hard to argue with that kind of logic, isn't it? And not because the logic isn't arguable, because the logic doesn't exist. But that's their reasoning. They saw Trophimus with Paul earlier in the city, so they assume that Paul brought him into the temple. And so verse 30, then all the city was stirred up and the people ran together. This is now spread outside the temple precincts. The people have heard the ruckus in the temple, and now all the men of the city are starting to rush together towards the temple. Remember, this is a feast day. There are thousands upon thousands of Jewish pilgrims in the city. And they are all highly zealous for the law, for the temple, for the Jewish people. And now they hear there's a challenge to it. They hear there's a big problem. So, obviously, what they do, they seize Paul. They drag him out of the temple, and at once the gates were shut. Now, the gates are shut in order to prevent Paul from being killed inside the temple and thereby defiling the temple with blood. So, they drag Paul out of the temple, and the terms that are used there imply that this was not a gentle escorting, right? They could be literally dragging him by his heels across the pavement. And they're beating him the entire time. They get him outside the temple precinct, and then the temple guards, there were armed temple guards, would shut the door and guard the entrances from anybody coming into the temple precinct. Verse 31, as they were seeking to kill him, word came to the tribune of the cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. Now, we've looked at the Jewish side of things and said there was this great enthusiasm for the Jewish nation. There was a great patriotism rising up in the Jewish people. They were ready for armed rebellion against the Romans. Now put yourself in the side of the Romans and say, if you are a Roman soldier commanding 1,000 troops, is the term that's used there, the commander of 1,000 is the word tribune. So he commands the garrison that's in Jerusalem. You are charged with keeping peace in the city. What does this news look like to you? One of your servants comes in and says, Commander, there's a ruckus down in the temple. Now, we also know from some other historians that the Roman garrison was in a fortress called the Fortress of Antonia, and it was right next to the temple. And in fact, there was a little battle for a while that the Romans would build their fortress just a little bit higher than the wall of the temple. And then the Jews would build the wall just a little bit higher so they couldn't see in. And then the Romans would build theirs just a little bit higher. And it finally did end with the Roman a fortress being much, much taller than the walls of the temple, so the Romans could see into the temple. And not only that, they had a stairway that went right from the fortress down into the court of the Gentiles where Paul is. Okay. So the Roman commander, when he heard this report, had only to look out the window and see the tumult going on below him. And he can see what's going on. Now, knowing that this is a feast day, knowing that tensions are running high, but also knowing that Jewish patriotism was running very, very high, this Roman soldier knows he's got to act quickly before things turn into a full-scale riot. And since he is governing Jerusalem under the rulership of Felix, he knows that Felix's desires in this matter would be to brutally suppress any rebellion that starts in the city. And so, when word came to the tribune of the cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion, verse 32, he at once took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. Now, he gathers up his soldiers, but the terms that are used here, again, are in English, are still very plain. He took the soldiers and centurions. So, what's a centurion? Commander of how many troops? 100 troops, right? Century, 100 years. Ascent, 1/100th. All right, we get that Latin term there. And so a centurion commands 100 troops. How many centurions does he take with him? More than one. So he's got with him at least two centurions, which means there are at least 200 soldiers going down from the fortress. Now, he has a command of about 1,000 soldiers at his disposal. But probably looking out the window, he says, well, it doesn't look too big. I don't see any swords flashing. I think we can handle this with a small contingent. Let's get 200 men, maybe 300. And he gathers his centurions, get your troops ready. Probably within just a few moments' time of the ruckus starting, he's descending the stairway. End of verse 32. When they saw the tribune and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Implication being, they've been beating him for a little while. This is not the kind of beating that brothers do to each other just to prove who's stronger. This is the kind of beating intended to end somebody's life. Remember, they just dragged him out of the temple with the accusation that he's defiled the temple by bringing Gentiles into it. He therefore deserves to die. They don't bother to drag him outside the city like they did with Stephen, but they just start pounding on him with their fists, hoping to end his life. So the centurion comes up. The Jewish people see the centurion approaching. Remember, he's descending the stairs right into the court of the Gentiles where they are. And they see him and they back off. So verse 33, the tribune came up, arrested him, that's arrested Paul, ordered him to be bound with two chains, so we're going to make sure he can't cause any trouble. Probably the chains went from one soldier to another, so Paul's now chained to two of these soldiers. And he begins inquiring who he was and what he had done. You ever try to determine what happened when tensions are running high? Yeah, not easy to do, is it? And this Roman centurion, this tribune has this problem. He's trying to determine who Paul is because he just comes into the situation. He doesn't know what's going on. He just walks up and sees this crowd pummeling Paul. So he picks Paul up, chains him to two soldiers, both probably to keep him safe and to, you know, put some order into things. And he starts asking questions. Who is this guy? But verse 34, some in the crowd were shouting one thing and some another, and he could not learn the facts because of the uproar, so he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. In other words, I can't determine anything that's going on. There's too much commotion. He asks what's going on, and 14 people start shouting out who Paul is, and none of them agree with each other. 12 people are saying what he did, and none of them agree with each other. And so in order to try and find some peace and quiet where he can determine what's going on, he says, let's take Paul back to the fortress. We'll interrogate him, which of course means we're going to continue the job of beating him until he tells us what he's done. Verse 35, he came back to the steps, and he was actually carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the crowd. So they're escorting him back through the court of the Gentiles till they get to the steps that go up to the Antonia fortress. The crowd, seeing their opportunity to kill Paul disappearing like smoke, gets more violent. They actually start trying to rip Paul out of the soldiers' hands. They start trying to beat Paul even while he's chained to these two soldiers. That's bold, folks. And so because of the violence of it, the soldiers actually have to pick Paul up off the ground and carry him up the steps in order to protect him and keep him from being killed. And so when he came to the steps, he's actually carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the crowd. And the mob of the people followed, crying out, "Away with him! Away with him!" Now this is just not a statement that says we'd like to not see him anymore. Away with him is a term that means kill him, execute him, he deserves to die. They said the same thing of another person in Luke's gospel, the Lord Jesus. Away with him. We want him dead. Paul is in the temple, suffering the same fate that the Lord Jesus did, the people rejecting him, the people wanting him dead. The fellowship of his sufferings, exactly. That I might know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings. I want you to notice, too, what happens next, folks, as we get to this kind of climax of the text. Verse 37, as Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the tribune, "May I say something to you?" So he politely and very respectfully asks to talk to the tribune. Now, this surprises the tribune, number one, because of the politeness, but number two, the fact that Paul, can speak Greek and speaks it well. And he said, "Do you know Greek?" Now, Greek was the normal language of the day. It was the trade language. A lot of people knew Greek, but probably a lot of people in Israel only spoke Hebrew and didn't speak Greek very well. So when Paul says this, it alerts this tribune that something's up. In verse 38, he starts calling into question his original assumption. "Are you not then the Egyptian who recently stirred up a revolt and led 4,000 men of the assassins," that's the word Sicarii again, "out into the wilderness?" Because remember, that Egyptian got away. Josephus talks about this Egyptian and his uprising at this time. But the Egyptian got away, so this centurion's probably thinking to himself, "Ha ha, I got the guy. Oh, wait a second, you're not him? Who are you then?" Paul replied, "I'm a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia." Oh, that explains why you speak Greek so well. You grew up in a very Gentile city. There was a lot of Jewish presence there, but you grew up in a Roman city. And not a small one either, a citizen of no obscure city. So I beg you, permit me to speak to the people. This is a pretty bold request. And here's what I want you to think about with this, is these people were just beat the daylights out of you, trying to crack your skull open and end your life. Would you want to share the gospel with them? Would you have that presence of the mind of Christ to say, "I desperately want these people to be saved"? Paul tells us in Romans that he loves his native countrymen, and he even wishes that he himself could be accursed so that they might come to the knowledge of Christ. That kind of devotion to the gospel, that kind of passion to see the glory of God revealed in saving sinners, is astounding to most of us, because I think most of us probably wouldn't respond like this. We'd probably say something like, "They were beating me for no reason. Go get them. You got 200 swords here at your disposal." But Paul, wanting to fellowship in the sufferings of Christ, recognizes that his suffering has meaning, it has purpose. It's accomplishing the glory of God, and he knows his purpose in life is to preach the gospel. And so he says, "I can have one more opportunity to talk to my fellow countrymen about Christ. This might be it. I don't know. I might die here." Prophets have been telling him that chains, imprisonment, and sufferings await him in Jerusalem, and now it's finally coming to pass. And did you notice how this fulfills what he heard in Caesarea when Agabus came down and talked to him? Agabus comes down, takes his own belt off of him, ties up Paul's hands and feet, and says, "In this way, your fellow countrymen will deliver you over to the Gentiles." And here it's happening. The Jews take him into custody. They're the ones beating him. They may have had him tied up. Doesn't specifically say it, but they may have had him tied up, and now the Romans have got him. And so Paul's saying to himself, "This might be the end. My life might be over here, but I've got one more chance. Can I talk to these people?" In verse 40, when he had given him permission, standing on the steps, he motioned with his hand to the people. And we're not going to get into Paul's speech here, because it's a long one. It's got a lot in it that we want to cover. But I just want us to think about this for the moment. How much suffering are we willing to endure for the sake of Christ? I think we need to seriously consider this, because we live pretty comfortable lives. And I think, generally speaking, we expect that our lives should be comfortable. That hardship and pain are things that don't belong. I also think that we need to prepare ourselves, because it is not an unlikely scenario in which we start facing much more persecution, even in this country, than we have in the past. Read some stories of men and women who have gone before us and who have had to endure great suffering for the sake of Christ. It's not going to be enough that we just think of clever ways to present the gospel to unbelievers, but it's going to be something that we have to start setting in our own hearts and minds. Am I willing to endure that kind of rejection? Am I willing to endure that kind of persecution? Because I know that God's purposes in my life are partly to deliver the gospel. We're going to close with just this final song this morning.